Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In his best-selling book, Bowling Alone, The Collapse and Revival of the American Community, Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam wrote about the disintegration of America's social networks. In his latest book, he considers the plight of children in an increasingly economically segregated America, one in which the idea of social mobility now is more a theory than reality. Robert Putnam's new book is entitled Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. He joins us now by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Anne. I'm glad to be here.
The story of the decline of the American dream in your book begins in your hometown of Port Clinton, Ohio. 50 years ago, it was a launching pad for almost any sort of future, you wrote. But you said that these days, it's a split-screen American nightmare and typical of America.
That's right. We went back and I loved growing up in Port Clinton. It was a nice little town on Lake Erie and not very rich, not very poor. And as you say, when we now went back 50 years later to see what had become of my classmates from the class of 1959, what we discovered is that the vast majority of my classmates had made it higher up the economic ladder than their own parents. Almost 80% of them had gotten more education than their parents. They had done better economically. And it didn't much matter whether you came from the right or wrong side of the tracks back in Port Clinton in the 1950s. Virtually everybody made it up the ladder. That was sort of the American dream. How far you got up the ladder depended upon, you know, your God-given talents and how hard you worked, but not on what your parents did or didn't do. But when we went back to Port Clinton now, 50 or 60 years later, and talked to kids there, we found that Port Clinton, a little tiny town, had been transformed in fundamental ways. The end of manufacturing in Ohio in general, but especially in my part of Ohio, caused lots of blue collar jobs to go away. The poverty rate went way up in Port Clinton, and the number of single families, kids living in single families, went way up. But meanwhile, along the shore in Port Clinton, which is beautiful, a new kind of gated community has grown up that's about 20 miles long along the shore and about 150 yards deep, and million-dollar homes there, and the kids from those homes come to Port Clinton High School, many of them, or at least some of them, driving BMW convertibles that their, you know, parents have bought for them, and park right next to in the Port Clinton High School parking lot. Park right next door to, you know, what we would have called jalopies or junkers. That is, wrecked cars or nearly wrecked cars in which the kids live are homeless kids. And you can drive down East Harbor Road from the center of Port Clinton, and if you look to the census tract on the left along the lake, the child poverty rate is zero. And if you look to the right, the census tract there dilapidated double wides and so on, the child poverty rate there is 50%. So in this tiny little community, you can see the growing separation and the growing polarization of American society along social class lines.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Robert Putnam, Malcolm Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. His latest book is entitled Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. If you have a question or comment for Bob Putnam, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also check out our Facebook page and post a question or comment there. Columbus is one of the most economically segregated cities in the country, second only to Austin, Texas. And that's been hard for a lot of people to hear. I imagine you've had the same response to what you're saying in your book. This is hard to hear.
Yeah, it's true. You know, people know, because of the national political conversation, they know about the growing income gap between, you know, very rich Americans and poor Americans, what we used to call the working class. They know about the income differences, but what they tend not to know or not to realize is that along with that economic polarization has come social segregation, frankly. Compared to 30 or 40 years ago, we are less likely to live near people from a different education educational level or a different social class, we're less likely to go to school with people who come from a different social class background, we're less likely to marry people of a different social background. So American society, although it's becoming more integrated in religious terms and somewhat more integrated in racial terms, is becoming less integrated in social class terms. And that means that many people on the upside of what we call the opportunity gap simply don't know anybody or any kids from the downside of the opportunity gap. And that, I think, is part of the problem.
And yet you titled the book Our Kids, the point being that this should matter to all of us, not just those whose children are the most handicapped by the economics of the 21st century, right?
Absolutely. It comes actually from, again, back from Port Clinton. When I was growing up in Port Clinton, my parents and their peers, other parents in town, when they use the expression our kids, we've got to do something for our kids. We've got to pay higher taxes to have a bond issue so we can have a new pool for our kids or a French department or whatever. When they used the expression our kids, they did not mean my sister and me only. Indeed, my parents kept voting for school pools and expansion of the French department and so on long after my sister and I were gone from Port Clinton. They meant all the kids in town were part of our kids. But over the last 30 or 40 years in America, not just in Port Clinton, in America, the meaning of the term our kids has become shriveled. So now when you hear people talk about our kids, they mean their own biological kids. And if you go to Port Clinton and talk to some of these really terribly poor, terribly isolated, terribly destitute poor kids up there, nobody in town thinks of them as they're one of our kids. They must be somebody else's kid and let them worry about them. And that's the psychological change that has accompanied the growing economic and social polarization.
Is the polarization, is that psychological change? I guess what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, probably, it's very complicated. Mm-hmm. Of course it is. And, basically everything caused everything else. I don't mean to be glib about it, but it's very hard to say, well, it was all the economics or the sociology or the psychology. I think probably the biggest factor initially were the closing of all those plants and the closing of the fisheries and the closing of the army base and so on around Portland. I think the economic change and the long, long, now 30 or 40 year long wage stagnation and economic stagnation for the working class, I think that's probably the most important factor in the background. But then that in turn has triggered real social changes and changes in the family structure of the working class and changes in the psychology, especially of people on the upside of the opportunity gap.
Socioeconomic barriers were at their lowest ebb in more than a century in the 1950s, but not for everyone. How does the plight of African Americans figure into the story and the history of this?
Well, for sure there was in Port Clinton, after all, this is the 1950s, and Port Clinton is a small town with very few black folks then or now. So there was definitely racism in Port Clinton when I was growing up. I talk about that at some length in the chapter on Port Clinton. Mm-hmm. In the book, I talk about I had two black classmates in my graduating class, and I talk about the race, the everyday daily racism that they encountered and the cross burning that happened and so on. So there was definitely, of course, I mean, it would be silly if I didn't say this, but there was definitely racism in Port Clinton. However, despite the racism, and despite their extremely humble origins, these two black kids in my class both were not hampered by class barriers. I mean by that in the following. Both of them came from homes in which no adult had ever gone past the third grade. They came from very modest, humble families in Port Clinton. Their dads were both manual workers. But the two kids I'm talking about, we describe them in the book. We give them fictional names, but in the book, one of them is called Cheryl and one of them is called Jesse. And Cheryl and Jesse were both smart and hardworking. They were well-received in the class. They both think that's true. They both graduated from Port Clinton High School, first in their families to graduate from high school. They both went to college. That's a big deal. They both got scholarships to go to college. They both graduated from college, an even bigger deal. They both went to graduate school. They both graduated from graduate school. So if you think about the upward mobility embodied in their lives, mm-hmm. from a third grade education in one generation to a graduate degree in the next generation, that's stunning. It's a tribute to their own talent. Of course it is. it's a tribute to the fact that they overcame racial barriers. Of course, that's true. But it's also a tribute to the fact that socioeconomic class was not a significant barrier to upward mobility in that era, and it is now.
So what changed? What about that? How did we change our psychology to how come just good hard work won't make it anymore?
Well, there, as I said before, there are a number of factors. The increasingly unequal distribution of income in America is in turn a consequence of.
But you said they came from very humble beginnings themselves.
No. I thought you asked what changed between then and now in America, in Fort Clinton, frankly.
Yeah.
What changed in America between then and now? I mean, these two black classmates of mine, are, you know, they're my age. They retired and they've had very successful lives and families and so on. But I thought you meant what had changed in America or in Port Clinton that accounted for the difference over time. Maybe I misunderstood your question.
Well, I don't even understand my own question when I come to this because it is so complicated. But they came from very humble beginnings. Why can't somebody from a very humble beginning today make a difference, achieve those same kind of things if they work hard, get good grades? What's the difference?
Well, let me just tick off the various ways in which this growing gap between rich kids and poor kids shows up in kids' lives, and I think that may help to clarify the story. Stability of families, family stability, there didn't used to be any big difference in family stability, single parents or whatever, between, college-educated Americans and what we used to call the working class. But now there's been a huge growing gap in family stability. So in America nationwide now, 8% of college-educated families are single-parent families as opposed to 65% of high school-educated families. So if you're growing up in a working class family today, you're 8 times more likely to be living with a single parent, probably a single mom. Mm-hmm. I'm not making a moral commentary on that. I'm just saying it's harder to raise kids if there's only one adult in the household. There's a growing difference in the amount of time and money that parents can invest in their kids. There's been a huge increase in the gap in terms of what parents spend on, you know, piano lessons or daycare or summer camp. That ratio now is about 7 to 1. The kids coming from college-educated homes get about 7 times more dollars spent on them than their classmates from a high school-educated home. And the same thing is true in investments in time with kids. So what we call good night moon time, that is the amount of time that parents spend reading to their kids, again, didn't used to be any gap. When I was growing up, there was no gap in the amount of time that parents, working class and middle class parents, spend with their kids. But now there's a 45-minute a day gap in the amount of reading time that kids get. And the average college-educated kid, by the time they get to school, has heard 30 million more words than the average kid from high school-educated homes. All of those things have powerful effects on the brain development of these kids. There are growing differences in the quality of schools kids attend. Now, in Port Clinton, there's only one high school, but in general across America, rich kids are now going to better schools than they used to, and poor kids are now going to worse schools than they used to. There's differences in the amount of community support, mentoring, and so on. The amount of, for example, going to church. There's been a much bigger fall in church attendance among working class families and their kids. And I'm not making a theological comment there. I'm just saying these kids are less embedded in support communities like religious communities. And there's a big difference, too, in what we call airbags. And I'll just end with this point in the following sense. Bad things happen to all kids. All kids get into trouble. My kids got into trouble. Your kids get in trouble. All kids get in trouble. Mm-hmm. Drugs or teen sex anorexia or ADHD or whatever, they have problems. Mm-hmm. But what happens nowadays in a well-off family is that if something bad happens, invisible airbags inflate to protect the child. You know, you jump in and you find the right doctor, or you get the kid to some rehab facility or whatever. But what happened? These poor kids, and this did not used to be the case, poor kids are increasingly isolated from everybody, from their parents, from their schools, from their communities, from their churches, from their neighbors. And so when the same bad thing happens to a poor kid nowadays, no airbags inflate, and they just themselves bear the cost of that problem. So there, in other words, there are many, many ways, from family structure to investments to social support, in which this gap between rich kids and poor kids has grown.
We are talking with Robert Putnam. He's Malcolm Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. His new book is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. If you have a question or comment for Robert Putnam, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can join the conversation by emailing us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In Ohio, 43% of public school students statewide qualify for subsidized meals. The question that the executive director of the Ohio Association of Food Banks asked recently was whether this is the new normal. Harvard political scientist and best-selling author Robert Putnam writes about the equation of poverty and how it figures into the larger question of social mobility in the 21st century in his new book entitled Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Robert Putnam, thanks again for joining us today.
It's a great pleasure, Anne. I'm enjoying the conversation.
I remember visiting what at the time was the poorest school district in Ohio back in the 1990s, and the superintendent made the point to me that more important than money was exposure, that most of the kids in her district would never even know a lawyer or a doctor unless it was for the wrong reasons. They needed a lawyer or they were sick, a scientist or anything like that, that there were no swimming pools or art galleries, and then little or no internet access was expected in coming years, or the technology to use it to see art galleries even remotely, that her kids just weren't getting enough exposure to the outside world.
Yeah, that's I don't know the school district, but that's certainly true. What you report is certainly true nationwide. I'm almost certain that the school district you're talking about there was a school district that mostly served low-income kids, because I'm certain that there you could find schools in around Columbus or around in certain parts of outside of Cleveland and so on, where there are plenty of affluent kids and they have plenty of exposure. They do go to France in the summer. They do take piano lessons. They do, use the internet to find out lots of interesting things. What's changed now from 40 or 50 years ago is that because of growing class segregation or separation, rich kids are going to school now almost exclusively with other rich kids, and poor kids are going to school with other poor kids, and that means there's less mixing and less opportunity for poor kids to learn from their peers, because their peers are in the same plight that they are. And that's one important aspect of this growing opportunity gap. It's not actually the schools cause the problem. It's not the schools mm-hmm. that cause the problem, but that's the site of the problem. That's where you can see it most clearly in schools.
And the problem is exacerbated because the rich kids aren't exposed to the poor kids.
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
They're missing out on some life skills that way as well.
Sure, and that's exactly right. And then in addition, of course, there's the fact that the parents of the rich kids are less likely to ever be exposed to poor kids, because their kids are just, their friends of their own rich kids or other rich kids. So people with money and power are, it's not that they're evil, but that they have less exposure now than would have been true 40 or 50 years ago to kids from the wrong side of the tracks, and that means they just are less likely to know how bad off these poor kids are. That was true for me personally, and when I went back to Portland, I was shocked. I had grown up in modest circumstances in Portland, and I'd done pretty well, and I thought, well, I pulled myself up and worked hard and have had a successful career, and I assume that other kids, you know, poor kids nowadays can do that. And what I learned to my horror, personally, was that that is no longer possible for kids coming from these very isolated and poor family backgrounds in Portland or any place else around America.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam. We're discussing the topic of his new book. It's called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Carol in Granville, you're on the air. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'm calling with a comment that I think a problem, I happen to live in a very upper class community, and one of the problems that we've been discussing, myself and other parents, is that we find ourselves providing too many airbags, as he used the term, and seeking out ways to have our children interacting with children of other socioeconomic status. And I think it's a hard habit to break, providing an airbag. And then, you know, the research now is that children who do well have something that is, you know, grit.
Right.
And so, of course, if we're always protecting our children and stepping in, they never learn on their own.
Mm-hmm. So
can I just say I agree completely with Carol. I mean, Carol, I value your comment and you're describing exactly what we have found across the country. We, in the course of writing this book, we did interviews all across America, not just with kids from poor backgrounds, but also in the same very same communities, we did interviews with kids from affluent backgrounds, like Carol's family, as she describes it. And so we can see very clearly within the same community the differences, these class differences that Carol is describing.
You know, Carol, thank you so much for your call. Is this just, this can't be just a matter of exposing rich kids, and I know we're generalizing about what rich is, but just exposing rich kids, having them go work at the local food bank or something like that, because what you experienced growing up in Port Clinton was an everyday, organic experience of growing up with kids from different circumstances.
That's absolutely right. That's completely right, Anne. And I want to try to be clear here that it's not that I'm saying, well, to fix this problem, we need to have kumbaya and everybody huddle around the campfire and hold hands with people from different class backgrounds. That might be a good idea, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the investment that we as Americans are making or not making in the lives and in the futures of kids coming from impoverished backgrounds. This is not just a matter of philanthropy or just a matter of empathy. It's these kids are going to be less productive citizens. They, if we don't help them by investing money and time with them, they will be less productive. Our economy will be, all of us will be poor because these people are not going to be able to contribute to the economy. They don't have the skills and they don't have the soft skills necessary to work in a modern economy. They don't have the grit and so on that is needed. It's not like I'm not at all saying that they're dumb or they don't have the ability. I'm saying we have not invested in them the way we invest in our own kids, in mm-hmm. providing them with good schools and opportunities and so on. And so it's going to be bad for all of us if we don't invest more time and energy and money, frankly, as well, in these poor kids. You know, I'm not, you know, whether we should invest more money in the kids, in the poor kids' parents is a different question. Some of these working class parents are, frankly, you know, they've been damaged by their life experiences and their addictions and other things in the lives of the adults. But the kids didn't cause that. And so what I'm trying to say is we have an obligation and we have an interest in in doing more to help all of our kids prosper.
Carl in New Albany, you're on the air. Hi, Carl.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to comment on two things. First of all, regarding the grit or emotional resiliency, I think if all the data starts pointing to it's actually the boys, regardless of socioeconomic level, that are being pulled away in relation to the girls, and that the affluent boys will have a safety net in their families that will protect them, whereas the lower socioeconomics will not. But what I specifically wanted to comment on was studies that The Economist pointed out in regards to segregation based on affluence in the UK, and how actually the lowest economic subsets in Britain, specifically Pakistanis, different Sudanese immigrants, were thriving in segregated groups in a way that neighborhoods where it was mixed with affluent and above were not. What they discovered was is the children of wealthy students in an overly middle to poor income actually did poorly and acted out. And the same thing that the poorer students in an overly affluent area would not leverage the resources in the way that if everyone in their group was provided the same resources and they weren't trying to compete for the social mobility on a social level. So, and I really agree with what he has to say is building a baseline, not based on zip code, but on academic opportunity across socioeconomic levels.
Robert Putnam?
Well, thanks for that, Carl. As it happens, I do spend a fair amount of time in the UK and working with the UK government, so I'm familiar with the situation there, too. The situation in the U.S. is actually somewhat different from the situation in the UK, but in the U.S., the data, and you described some complicated interactions mm-hmm. between the ethnicity and the social class of the kids and their peers. In the U.S., the data are pretty clear, and this now goes back 40 or 50 years, that the data have shown that peer effects, that is, the effects of the kids you go to school with, are very, very important. And so if you're rich or poor, whether you're rich or poor yourself, you're better off going to school with other kids from affluent backgrounds, because those kids bring to school with them from their homes high expectations and high support and sometimes even, you know, money for supporting extras at school. I mean, for everybody, extras at school. So that's true whether you're poor or rich. You're better off going to school with kids who are rich. And conversely, whether you're rich or poor, you're worse off if you're going to school in a low-income school, because those kids are generally bringing with them in their backpacks when they come to school, not parental support. They're bringing, you know, through no fault of their own, not the kids' fault, but they're bringing gang violence and family upheaval and so on, and that harms the learning environment for all the kids. There are a number of case studies in the book Our Kids, the new book Our Kids, which shows two schools pretty close to each other, very very similar kinds of kids going to those schools, but one is in a very poor neighborhood and the school is terrible, and the other is in a very affluent neighborhood and the school is rich. It's good. This rich school is good for everybody, the rich kids and the poor kids. And the poor school is bad for everybody, both rich kids and poor kids.
Thank you, Carl, for that call. Carl raised something that I thought we could chat about, is ethnicity. You write that the opportunity gap between rich and poor kids is widening, even among ethnic minorities. And you highlighted two second-generation Latinas who live a short car drive from each other in Orange County, California. What's the significance of that?
Well, that's actually the case that I was just referring to when I talked about good schools and bad schools. Yes, in that case study, we talked to two Latino families. They're both of these families are second generation Latino families. One of them, and they both live in Orange County. They only live about 10, 15 minutes drive away. But one of these families has had great success, and the family is quite affluent, and they're sending their kids to the local high school. They moved to this area precisely because it's an affluent area with good schools, and their school is one of the best high schools in America. Actually, it's rated the 32nd best high school in America. Mm-hmm. But then 10, 15 minutes drive away, another second-generation Latino family, but this one is the family is much poorer and much more fragmented, and they live in one of the most dangerous, statistically speaking, one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in America. high levels of gang violence and poverty and deprivation in the surroundings for these girls, and they go to one of the worst high schools in America. And it's not because, I mean, in both cases, the kids themselves are gifted and talented, but a gifted and talented kid from an affluent neighborhood is just living a completely different life than mm-hmm. a gifted and talented person who has to go to a local impoverished school.
Neighborhoods matter. I mean, there's a whole issue of high crime is a big problem.
Yeah, it's true. Now, because in that case, both of those kids are coming from Latino backgrounds, from non-white backgrounds, you can see that it's the class difference that makes the difference. It's not ethnicity, because that's a constant in these two cases. But, and this goes to your larger question about ethnicity, of course, there's an overlap in America between race and class. Non-white kids, especially black kids, but non-white kids in general, are likely to come from poor homes. And they actually have a double whammy because there is still racial prejudice and intolerance, and there's purely racial prejudice and intolerance in America, and they suffer from that. But in addition, they suffer from economic poverty, and they're hurt by that, but so are white kids affected by economic poverty. And most of the growth in the opportunity gap that we document in the book is actually about class. It's not about race. I'm not saying race is unimportant. On the contrary, race is very important. We still have important racial inequities to discuss and to resolve. But I am saying that the new news here is that there is a rapidly growing class gap which affects both black kids and white kids and you know, Latino kids and so on.
My guest is Robert Putnam. We're talking about his new book, Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. The idea of basic needs has changed over time. Food and shelter, always a given, but now we also need some semblance of technology, be it cable television, internet access, or cell phone service, to rise above the fray of the 21st century. That costs money. And in a state where half of the residents are living paycheck to paycheck, any interruption can be a catastrophe. And other costs that many of us take for granted have increased beyond the pale, according to the Ohio Association of Community Action Agencies. Tuition is 23 times higher at some schools than 50 years ago, and health care is up 869%. Harvard political scientist and award-winning author Robert Putnam writes about how these challenges are testing the fundamental precepts of the proverbial American dream. His new book is entitled Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis, and he's with us by telephone. Thanks again, Bob, for joining us today.
It's great to be with you. I'm enjoying the conversation with you and your listeners.
I wanted to turn to a listener right now. Linda in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak with you. I'm calling on behalf of our son. My husband and I have one child who has lived in our home for 20 years and has worked diligently in the community trying to beautify it and clean it up with the vacant lots and the highways and things of that nature, as well as tutoring other children and helping at food bank pantries.
Mm-hmm.
He's been doing this for years, and a few weeks before going to college, our house caught on fire. And he still diligently continues years he's been doing this, and there's been no resources made for us. Even so much as the I Am Wrath production was filmed across our street of our home, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And we can still continue to labor in trying to beautify our community. We have an articulate young man who is extremely, extremely diligent in this community, and we cannot find the resources to help us.
He can't catch a break. Robert Putnam?
Well, first of all, Linda, I think anybody listening to you is moved by your account of the challenges you're facing, especially after the fire. And secondly, I think you must be extremely proud of the son that you've raised. He sounds like a terrific kid, despite all these challenges. And that's what we are finding all over America, that there are decent kids coming from decent homes, but low-income homes, and they're simply unable in today's world to develop their talents to the same degree that other kids, similar kids, coming from well-off backgrounds.
And then when a catastrophe strikes, like a house fire, there's no invisible airbag there.
Exactly right.
Linda, thanks for that call. I want to turn now to David in Columbus. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm watching the show. I think that really the real problem and the cause of the problem of these gaps is not being addressed by Mr. Putnam or by anything anybody said so far. And in fact, I seldom hear anything. It seems that the solution always seems to be that we need more programs from the government. We need more spending. And yet, in fact, in my opinion, the government spending is a lot of the problem. And we're not really, we're looking at polarization between the rich and the poor, but nobody's talking about what has happened to all of the places in the middle. For example, the way things are set up right now, I had a job, for example, myself, that paid for the government years ago, that paid $20 an hour. And I had children at home at the time. And I did the math, and I figured out between the taxes I was paying, I was taking home $13 an hour after all the taxation. Mm-hmm. And yet, if I had a job that paid $10 an hour, I would have brought home $11.50 because I would have gotten more government money from various government programs, including free lunch for the children, including the earned income credit. And I would have actually been a net recipient from the government rather than a taxpayer at $10 an hour. So the difference in pay between someone with children making $10 an hour and making $20 an hour was about $1.50 an hour. So there really was, it was a much more demanding job that I had than the $10 an hour jobs I could have had instead, that I've had since then, in fact. I'm currently working for $9 an hour. But there's really, it's really the roadblocks are set up that don't allow a person to get ahead, but are mostly set up by these government social programs.
Let's see. David, Robert Putnam, what about that? Have we maybe approached this in the wrong way over the past 50 years?
Well, I appreciate David's perspective on this, and he's got experience that I don't have. On the other hand, I need to clarify a couple of things. Just for convenience and sake of quickness, I've been talking about rich kids and poor kids, but actually, in our work, by rich, I do not mean Bill Gates, and by poor, I do not mean homeless people. I'm talking about, when I talked about poor kids, I was talking about kids coming from the lower third, not the lower 1%, not the poorest of the poor, but the lower third of American homes, which means basically homes in which nobody had gotten past high school. This is, in fact, what you used to call the working class. So I'm very much concerned about what became of the working class. It's the kids of the former working class that I'm talking about. I'm not just talking about kids, who are living in destitute economic circumstances. I'm talking about the kids of the former working class. That's the first point. The second point is the amount of money being spent on government programs and raised in taxes, being invested in kids coming from the working class, has gone down over the last 20 or 30 years. At the same time, this gap has grown over the last 20 or 30 years. So it seems to me, I'm not talking about every single program that government does, but that an analysis that says, well, this is all big government and welfare spending and so on, doesn't really fit the data, because we've been spending less and less, despite maybe David's impression, but the data show we've been spending less and less in real dollars on welfare programs and on other programs for working class and poor kids. At the same time, the gap has been growing. So I don't, and moreover, I think it's not that my view is that this is all going to be done by the government, needs to be done by the government. I think there's a ton of things that should be done by local communities, by church groups, and by other local groups, not government at all, to provide more, as I said, more airbags for kids in poor backgrounds, to provide more mentoring for kids in those backgrounds. I think there's a lot we can do that's not just the government.
David, thanks a lot for that call. Kathy from Ostrander, you're on the air. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I wanted to talk about school funding, especially in the state of Ohio. I'm a young parent. My children are just now entering public school. I'm a big proponent of public schools and not so much into the charter school thing. But what I think segregates us a lot in Ohio, especially, is the way we fund our schools. Olentangy, of course, is one of the fastest growing schools in Ohio, and anybody who can will move their child into that school district that's rated, like A-plus or something, is known to be one of the best. But the property taxes are such that there's no way my family could afford to live in a place like that. Whereas it's also pushing out some of the working class people, like he was talking, like people have to sell their properties and move out of there because the property taxes are so high. My kids go to Fairbanks School District. Now Kasich's talking about taking from those smaller...
Governor Kasich, yeah.
Yeah, sorry.
That's okay.
It's a smaller school district in Union County, but he's talking about taking from districts like that and giving to Olentangy because Olentangy is rapidly growing. Well, it's rapidly growing because people want their kids to be in the best schools. Whereas in Fairbanks, my neighbors that have no children are telling me they don't think they should even have to pay for schools because they don't have any kids in the schools. And it all goes back to that community feeling that he's talking about. These are our kids. You want to live in a community where you have well-educated kids that are the future generation.
You'd think so, Kathy, but Robert Putnam, why do people say they don't want to pay for good schools and they want... There's a disconnect there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, absolutely there's a disconnect, and I appreciate very much Kathy's points. I'm going to try to skip talking about the details of school politics in Ohio, but maybe I can be helpful by giving a little bit of history here, because there's an important earlier period in American history that is surprisingly relevant to our time. The last time we had this degree of economic inequality in America was about 100 years ago in the 1890s, what was called the Golden Age, and there were extremes of wealth and poverty in that period. And then people began gradually to think, well, wait a minute, this can't be America. We can't live in a place that is this unequal. And then America made, not nationally, but in scores of towns and cities all across America, especially in the Midwest, America made the best public policy decision we have ever made. America invented free public high school. God did not invent high schools. High schools were invented by American reformers in about 1910, and that was the best decision we ever made because it simultaneously did two things. It raised the whole level of productivity of America because all of our workers had much more skill having been to high school, and that meant that the 20th century was the American century. We did better than any place else in the world because we were spending more on education than any place else in the world. That's point one. Point two, it simultaneously leveled the playing field because every kid got a free high school education, and that meant it was both good for the economy as a whole and good for the American dream, for opportunity for all kids. It involved, now I'm going back exactly to this issue of who pays for schools, to do that it required that rich folks in some local community in Kansas or in Ohio, rich folks in town, the banker or the lawyer or some wealthy farmer, had to agree to pay taxes to support other people's kids' education. And it was kind of a bet that those folks were making that in the long run, they'd all come out ahead. And that bet paid off enormously well in those towns and across America. So I think we should not think about this as, helping somebody's poor kid is going to be bad for me because I don't have any kids. The whole country will be better off if we invest in everybody's kids, not just our own personal, biological kids.
Email from Kim in Upper Arlington. She writes, the class difference is also creating a want of compassion, which means that our leaders who come from the elite classes will find it easier and easier to pass laws which leave poor children behind. And you have said that there is a moral and for many a religious imperative to not ignore these kids.
Well, I believe that. I do believe it. And I believe actually that America's religious communities need to step up to this task. Religion is an important part of American society and a very important part of American public policy debates. And I think not all religious communities have stepped up to this task. You know, I'm not going to start quoting scripture here, but it's clear that all of our religions say we've got to pay special attention to poor kids. That's actually read the Sermon on the Mount. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe the most important thing that's happened to the debate in America, it's still happening, is that Pope Francis, I should say I'm not Catholic, but Pope Francis's language about this is even more impassioned than mine. And I feel pretty strongly about it. And I think that illustrates why, how, if our religious communities did begin to step up to the task of talking about our moral responsibilities, I think that could change the whole climate of opinion in this country. It's not just about morals. It's not just about having empathy for poor kids, as I just finished saying in the answer to the previous question. It's also in our own self-interest to help other people's kids. But certainly there's no doubt that there's an important moral dimension to this.
I want to just squeeze in one more call from Michelle in Upper Arlington. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Conversation is pretty near and dear to my heart. I previously spent the first 20 years of my adult career stepping out of student teaching and taught with the public school system, the large urban school system here. And the one thing I really wanted to stress is that I feel very displaced my own self. I chose to resign from a school system that was bigger than me and issues that, you know, I don't even want to get into. It's been in the news for years.
Mm-hmm.
However, what has me gripped is that one of my students had said to me, never mistake kindness for weakness. And these are high school kids with juvenile issues and so forth and so on. And within that classroom, what I was teaching or what they were learning, I was learning from them as much. These things didn't quite fit the mold of what the state's looking for or what an observer's looking for. But they are very insightful, and as I, like I said, don't define yourself by zip code, whichever one you're living in. I wouldn't tell them that my kids go to school in Upper Arlington City Schools because I thought that just wasn't something I should share. I'm a mm-hmm. public school teacher, and I give a shout-out to all the people who are hardworking and these kids. I've seen them, and I see what they come in with and what they go home with. And sometimes in that classroom, you're trying to teach what you should be by the Common Core, the state learning, and so forth and so on. But it's just a whole different ballgame. And like I say, don't define yourself by zip code. The season never ends.
Okay.
And on that note, they've left me with something that I'm not sure what I want to do now because I can't say enough how much they impacted my life. And okay. What I learned from them.
Michelle, thank you so much. I'm sorry we're running out of time. And Robert Putnam, just a thought about Michelle. It sounds like she's struggling with this.
Well, it sounds like Michelle actually offers lots of firsthand testimony about mm-hmm. the realities of this problem in schools in Ohio and, frankly, also schools all across the United States. And not just schools, but in communities all across the United States. So I enjoy talking with your visitors, your visiting with your callers, and I give a shout-out to Michelle for the work she did.
All right. Robert Putnam, thanks so much for joining us today.
Great pleasure.
Robert Putnam, he's Malcolm Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. His new book is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, All Sides interns Michael Hepburn, Shahina Sagiri, Hannah Palmer, Abdul Rahman Al-Ruwe Shan, and with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.